Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From kangaroos bred in captivity to trained tigers, exotic pets come from all walks of wildlife. And ownership of wild animals is increasingly becoming a hot debate. Exotic pet owners defend their right to care for critters from venomous snakes to angry chimps. Animal rights advocates, meanwhile, are doing what they can to stop the purchase of exotic pets and to place current ones into safe, accredited sanctuaries. However, both camps appear to share a love of wild animals. Joining us is Lauren Slater, an animal lover herself, who wrote about the exotic animal ownership debate for National Geographic. Lauren Slater, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you looked into some of the motivations for why people buy and keep exotic pets. What did you find?
I found that there were a couple of different motivations. I mean, the ones that come immediately to my mind are some people buy exotic pets as a sort of status symbol, keeping up with the Joneses type of thing. If the neighbor has, a Bengal cat, then the other person's going to go out and purchase a cougar, just to one-up them sort of thing. And while that sounds strange, that really is a motivation. I mean, there's something exotic and certainly expensive about having, say, a wild cat. But the most common motivation had to do with people falling in love with these animals when they're babies, the mammals especially, like the tigers and the cat. And then taking them home and raising them. The problem, of course, comes in these animals don't stay babies. They grow up and they reach sexual maturity, and then oftentimes problems begin.
Right. They sort of treat them as surrogate children. And eventually, I guess, these children have to be sometime declawed or defanged.
Yeah, and even then, you can declaw, defang, de-whatever your exotic or wild animal, but you can't take its genetic material out of it. And I'm thinking of Michelle Burke, who I interviewed, who had a kinkajou, which is a relatively small animal, wild animal. And the kinkajou's name was Winnie, and she was a beloved family pet. They actually bought her on Craigslist, and they dressed her up in clothes and, anthropomorphized her in all sorts of ways. And then Winnie, at some point, a couple of years down the road, went into her first heat. And she started attacking them and also attacking herself out of just sheer kind of hormonal frustration. Mm. And that was a terrifying experience for the family. This beloved, sweet kinkajou just became a raging monster. And they gave her up after that.
Well, there are some very gruesome tales of exotic animals turning on their owners. Apparently there's a database. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of things get recorded?
Well, first of all, that database is at Born Free USA, and you can go online and look it up. But the first thing you need to know about that database is it's probably radically incomplete. Born Free USA only reports on reported incidences. It's safe to assume that the vast majority of these incidences go unreported. So obviously Born Free USA has no way of knowing how many, violent incidences actually occur with exotic animals as pets. Mm. Again, they report on the ones that make it into the news or the newspaper. And even with that severe limitation on what they can list, there's still, you go on that site and you look at the incidences and it's, someone in Arizona was gutted to death by his kangaroo, by his pet kangaroo. Someone had their hand bitten off by a bear. Three venomous snakes were found in the, waiting area of the airport. And the list goes on and on.
Wow. Well, what are the current regulations for purchasing and caring for exotic animals?
Well, I think one of the problems with the regulations is that they're not at all consistent from state to state. I live in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, it's 100%, it's clear, it's 100% illegal to have any kind of wild animal. as a pet. And I think it's the same for New Hampshire. But, for instance, in Ohio, there used to be no regulations on whether or not you could have wild animals. And Ohio, in fact, is full of people who have wild or exotic animals as pets.
Remind us of the story, that gruesome story in Ohio from a couple of years ago that set the regulations off.
A man named Jerry Thompson had a menagerie of wild animals on his property. And that actually is not so uncommon. These people who have wild animals as pets will sometimes actually kind of collect them. So he had a large collection of wild animals, tigers, other kinds of large cats, zebras. I mean, it was truly a menagerie. And for whatever reason, and no one really knows what his motivations were, what was going on with him, he let them all loose, you know, 20 or 30 of these wild animals that were living in enclosures on his property in Zanesville, Ohio. Zanesville is not the country, it's a suburb. He let them all loose, and then he killed himself. He shot himself. The sheriff's force had two choices. They could try to dart the animals, basically, you know, shoot them full of medicated darts that would quiet them down and somehow rescue them, or they could just shoot them and kill them. Those darts that you can shoot into animals that quiet them down take a long time to work. And meanwhile, there were people going to work in Zanesville, and the animals were running in front of cars, and there was a good chance they were going to attack, you know, an unsuspecting citizen. So the sheriff's department really felt they had no choice but to slaughter all of the animals to kill them.
So as a result, Ohio's kind of clamping down on the exotic pet ownership. What are they doing?
Well, the first thing I think they did was they made it illegal to have wild animal auctions. I think that happened immediately in the aftermath of Zanesville. And now they are requiring that all wild animal owners register their animals with a central registry and also pay something like $3 to $5 million in insurance to have these animals, which makes it pretty much impossible to have. I mean, not many people can afford to buy insurance like that.
We're speaking with Lauren Slater. She's an author of several books and also an article in the current National Geographic about exotic animal ownership and the debate going on in several places about whether or not people should be allowed to keep exotic animals. Lauren, you write in your article that it's believed that more exotic animals live in American homes than are cared for in American zoos. What is the case that wild animal owners are making for why they should be allowed to keep these animals?
Well, there's a group called REXANA, which stands for Responsible Exotic Animal Ownership. The case that they make and the case that other people who own these exotic animals would make is that, number one, the number of violent incidences that happen with these exotic animals is actually lower than the number of violent incidences that happen with domestic animals. Hmm. So if you go on Born Free USA's website and you look at their incidences of wild animal attacks on human beings, you'll find, you know, hundreds of incidences listed there. But there are more incidences of people visiting the ER for, say, dog bites. Hmm. The other argument that they make is that it's, you know, it's within their rights as, you know, a United States citizen to own these animals, and restricting them from owning them is in interfering with their, you know, personal freedom that comes with being a citizen of the United States. And a third argument would be that wild animals have been kept by humans and human civilizations for as long as civilization has been around, which is about 12 or 13,000 years, and probably even before civilizations were actually constructed, people probably kept wild animals as pets, so that there's a long history to this. You know, but again, it comes back to the baseline argument, is that it's no more or less safe or unsafe than having a dog or a cat.
How about the argument against wild animal ownership made by animal rights activists?
Well, there's a lot of arguments, but I think the first one is that there is a big difference between a domesticated and a wild animal. of all of the large land mammals that roam this earth, and there are, you know, hundreds, only 13 of them, I think, have been successfully domesticated over thousands and thousands of years. To domesticate an animal takes thousands and thousands of years of culling from the gene pool and selective breeding. So a domesticated animal has a different genome from a wild animal. And when you take a wild animal and put it into a domestic situation, its natural inclinations, its very genetic structure does not mesh with a domestic situation. In other words, it's meant to be a wild animal. It's not meant to live in captivity. It's not going to flourish in captivity, and therefore presents dangers in captivity to both the owner and to the animal. Mm. For instance, when that, you know, a couple of years ago, I'm sure some of your listeners, or maybe all of them, heard of the terrible incident with the chimpanzee in Connecticut.
Oh, right, he mauled a woman's face.
Terribly mauled a woman. Now, that chimpanzee, you know, needed to be killed. So, you know, it came to a terrible, terrible end for both the chimpanzee primate and the human primate. Both were, one was killed and one was irrevocably mauled. So, you know, these are some of the arguments against it. It's not good for humans and it's not good for animals. Wild animals are meant to live in the wild. They are not meant to live in captivity.
I'm guessing that you've seen the film Grizzly Man.
Yes, I have seen that film.
Which was not about domesticating an animal, but this whole idea that human beings can somehow commune with wild animals. You spoke to somebody who owns many species of exotic animals about that exactly. What'd she say? Leslie Ann Rush is who I'm thinking of.
Yes. She's a wonderful woman who owns four kangaroos and several leaping lemurs and an exotic Asian deer and a pot-bellied pig, which actually is not a wild animal, but that was thrown into the mix, and a dog named Rover. And first of all, Leslie Rush differentiates herself from other kinds of wild animal owners in that she doesn't own any predators. So I don't think that Leslie Rush would go out and buy a predator animal. But kangaroos can be dangerous. They have a claw that's, you know, I think it's actually called a kill claw, and it can, you know, gut a human without any problem. She would say that, you know, these animals are being kept in perfect conditions. They are happy. They are well cared for. They are loved. And they provide a central sort of hub for her life. Her entire life revolves around taking care of these animals. And furthermore, some of the lemurs that she has are endangered species, and she believes that by keeping these lemurs safe, she's doing her part to protect and perpetuate the endangered species of lemur that she actually has. So that would be what, if she were here, that might be something that she would say. And for sure, her animals, they were well kept. I mean, and she does, you know, spend most of her life taking care of them, so they are taken care of excellently.
Lauren Slater, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Lauren Slater is the author of several books, including most recently The $60,000 Dog, My Life with Animals. She wrote the article called Wild Obsession, which is about the debate over owning exotic animals. It's in the current issue of National Geographic. We have a link to her article and more, including some fantastic photographs of animals in captivity from the article. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Most Americans don't have to go home to walk the kangaroo or feed the boa constrictor, but we are wild for animals. The American Pets Production Association estimates that 68% of U.S. households own a pet, over 83 million dogs among them. Joining me now is one such dog owner, Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby, who's got a little show and tell of sorts, or I don't know, I guess we should call it a play and listen.
Yeah, so I should just, I have a dog, she's about 8 pounds, she's half Chihuahua, half something else, we don't know, she's kind of a mutt. And she makes a lot of funny noises, as many pets do, but especially when she's begging for attention, specifically if she wants to be pet, she makes a sound that sounds nothing like a dog. Take a listen.
Objectively, if I was listening to this, it kind of sounds like somebody unzipping a sleeping bag.
It does sound like a zipper, like a tent or a sleeping bag zipper.
It sounds exactly like a tent.
What's your dog's name?
Angel.
All right, we're going to throw the challenge out to you. Does your pet make a weird sound? Maybe your cat sounds something like this. Oh, my God. Or maybe your dog sounds something like a woman wailing. Or maybe you have a pet goat, and it sounds just like a shouting man.
Oh, that's my favorite one. I hope somebody out there has a pet goat.
Is that real? Yeah. How can that be real?
Oh, YouTube.
All right, so prove it yourself. Go to the voice memo feature on your smartphone and hit record, or take a video of your pet in action and then send it to us. There are step-by-step instructions to do so on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is going to continue with a story from the wilds of the Granite State and a look into why New Hampshire's bat population has declined dramatically in recent years and what that means for our ecosystem. That story after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New Hampshire is home to 8 species of bats. And of those 8, 3 migrate south for the winter and 5 hibernate to survive. April is the month for bats to emerge from hibernation, but a fatal syndrome has been decimating the population for years. NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown brings us the story.
White-nose syndrome has been present in Europe for a while, but it was first found in New Hampshire in 2009, and it didn't take long to start doing harm.
In 2010, we had some huge losses. It was really quite scary.
Emily Preston is a biologist at Fish and Game. She says as the disease started to accelerate, biologists decided to pull the plug on bat surveys. They reasoned disturbing the animals in the abandoned mines where they spend the winter would lead to even higher mortality.
Look, there's scat down there.
But this winter, they went back for the first time in 3 years. It was kind of like walking into an abandoned city or the set of a post-apocalyptic Hollywood movie.
No, nothing.
Fish and Game provided this audio of Preston and another biologist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service surveying one site. There used to be 3,230 bats in the state's 4 biggest hibernating colonies. This year's count found 16. 2 of what had been the most common species, the northern long-eared and the little brown bat, were missing entirely. I caught up with Preston after the survey in her office.
In the top of the mines, there are old holes where they would drill in to put the dynamite. And the northern long-eared bats would pack themselves into these little holes. And you were trying to count their little noses to try to figure how many bats there were in there. And all of them were empty. There are no bats in them anymore. And it's so depressing.
Also depressing is the fact that white nose is extremely difficult to combat. The disease is incredibly contagious, particularly among cave hibernating bats. That's according to Ann Ballman, biologist at the National Wildlife Health Center.
When they gather together, it's very similar to the daycare theory where you have one sick child, you bring those into a population of susceptible children, and then you can spread the disease that way.
White nose doesn't even need a host, since it can live on the moist walls of the hibernacula.
So it has been demonstrated that the fungus itself will persist at a site once it's contaminated for many, many seasons, even if the bat population is drastically reduced.
The only treatment that has worked so far is repeatedly rubbing each individual bat with an antifungal ointment. And even this has only worked in the lab. The fungus itself grows into the bat's skin tissue, especially the wings. It messes with their ability to regulate their body temperature and moisture and causes them to wake from hibernation. And that, says Preston, makes them use up their fat stores.
When they're infected with white nose syndrome, they are waking up every 6 days. Basically, what they're dying of is starvation and dehydration because of the fact that they have burnt through their stored energy.
But it can also just cause lesions, an eventual tiny cardiac arrest.
Yeah, that'll do.
So far, with no clear way to fight the disease, wildlife officials are taking some standard countermeasures. keeping people out of caves in the winter, and asking spelunkers to disinfect their gear. And they want anyone who has survivors of the epidemic roosting in their house over the summer to find a way to coexist with them.
Look good.
But ultimately, if bats are going to recover in New Hampshire, it's all about the long game. That hinges on the very few bats that are still hanging on in Granite State mines.
We're hoping that they're passing on whatever that thing is that allows them to survive.
Biologists will be watching for that adaptation, whatever it is. So too, presumably, will the bats. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
If you'd like to see a startling evidence of the damage that white nose syndrome has caused, there's an infographic on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth continues with the story of a man who took on the ambitious task of transcribing the entire King James Bible by hand. First, the news.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The director Darren Aronofsky's biblical blockbuster Noah opened this past weekend to mixed reviews and a little bit of controversy. Some evangelical Christian groups criticized the film for not adhering closely enough to religious texts, which reminded us of a story of a man who never deviated from the text, quite literally. Philip Patterson, a 63-year-old retiree from Philmont, New York, spent 7 years working on a handwritten volume of the entire, meaning almost 800,000-word, King James Bible. Philip has AIDS and related illnesses, which often made the quest slow going, though he sometimes logged up to 18 hours a day of writing. I spoke with Philip last year, just a month after he completed the epic manuscript, and started the conversation by asking what possessed him to embark on such an ambitious project.
There were a number of reasons I took it on. One, because somebody suggested to me, and that would have been my late partner of 20 years, who suggested that I should do something that Muslims do and Jews do, and why don't Christians do it? I said, because it's too large a book. And he said, well, then you should do it.
So you're referring to how people used to transcribe texts in order to pass them on?
Yes, which they still do. I mean, Jews do it regularly, and Muslims do it as a devotion. And the other thing is, I wanted to know what was in it. I mean, I was raised in Christian schools, and nobody had ever actually read the Bible to me except for a couple of stories. I had no idea what was in it. We go to court, we swear on it. And I also wanted to represent handwriting in the 21st century. So there were all of those reasons that had nothing to do with devotion.
I'm wondering about the Bible in particular as a source text. I mean, you could have done the classics or the fall of the Roman Empire or whatever. Why the Bible?
Well, I did toy with doing the works of Shakespeare, but I also realized that the Bible is a book that's too mysterious to too many people. And I thought, okay, what is all this mystery about? And everybody says, oh, yeah, that book and that book, and they haven't read it.
So do you understand it better now that you have transcribed the whole thing?
I understand what I needed to get out of it for a first pass. I mean, I'm looking for an opportunity to do it again. When I say an opportunity, I just need a reason to do it again.
Wait, you're going to do all 788,000 words a second time?
Yes, I absolutely intend to. It was such an incredible, uplifting experience, mind-expanding. I discovered the magnitude of what we call God. And by calling it a name, the entity, the deity, whatever you like, by giving that source a name, you already belittle it. Because there isn't anything in human speak that can tell us of the size of this passion. I mean, the universe is passion. It's exploding. There's nothing, there's no word in our language that can speak to that. Ultimately, you know, I think the only thing that humans can grapple with from all of that is probably love. That's what it kind of all boils down to. It's not any more complicated than that.
How did your health complications affect this process?
At one point, I came down with a very life-threatening infection, and it didn't look as if I'd survive, and it kept me convalescing probably for about 6 months. And during that time, I would look over at my desk, which is in my bedroom, and I would think, oh my gosh, I really want to get back to it, but I don't have the strength. I can't sit up. And finally, one day, I just thought, okay, that's it. You're doing this. And I was back in the saddle, and everything was good.
Wow. At what point in the 7 years was that?
That was about 3 years ago, maybe 2 years ago, yeah.
All right, I have to ask you some more sort of technical questions about it. I mean,
sure.
How about making mistakes? If you do a typo, blunder, what do? Scratch it out?
Well, certainly there are a few inconspicuous blunders, but the big ones, and just do those signatures over again. I mean, I choose a 16-page signature, which is four pieces of paper that fit inside of each other. Fold one page in half, two pages, three pages, four pages, and they fit inside each other. Well, if you make a mistake at the end page of a 16-page signature, you have to go back and do four pieces of paper over.
Mm.
And you need to be skillful enough to fit them in with the other pages that you've already written. And you know, after a while, you think, okay, I can't keep doing this. Now I have to be extra vigilant.
Isn't that when the old monks of yore would sort of like create a dragon?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I don't have that skill.
And you're writing in cursive, correct?
Yeah, the Palmer method, which I learned in, I think, third grade.
Mm. You know they're not teaching cursive in grammar school anymore?
It's a crime. It's a total crime. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I am so excited about this volume, because whatever happens, this will always be what writing is in the 21st century. We had the writers of the Declaration of Independence, and that was what writing was then. You know, we had the writing of the monks, and that's what writing was then, and the Gutenberg Press was eventually, you know, brought to the fore. But nobody handwrites anymore because we all have computers. Lord knows I have two, sitting on my desk, and I know that people are not writing. I'm perfect evidence of it. So I choose to make a statement with cursive in the 21st century.
I wonder how it felt for you to do those final strokes after 7 years, those final words.
Well, it hadn't sunken in. I mean, I did the last two verses of Revelations in front of an audience of about 150. I was totally prepared for the moment. I knew I was going to do it, and that was going to be okay. But it hit me later, much later, what that really meant as people started responding from all over the world.
Mm.
I still haven't completely made peace with that. I mean, it's an amazing thing to think that this little task you're doing in your apartment in Philmont, New York, captures the imagination of people everywhere in the world. You know, we got newspapers from the Netherlands sent to us, and Australia. They're even talking about it in India. I mean, you practically need to be Justin Bieber to work that one out, you know.
So you're going to do it all over again.
I am going to do it again.
Philip Patterson, wonderful to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can find links to more on the project and on Philip's quest at wordofmouthradio.org.
You know, my favorite book would be the Book of Ruth, and that's because it's so honorable. But the passage that I come away with is the thing that sums up the entire book. You know, and if you just live by this one passage, your life can be very uncomplicated. And that is, love thy neighbor as thyself, the love of God. So, you know, that's it.
Philip Patterson there of Philmont, New York. He spent 7 years transcribing by hand the entire King James Bible. Stay with us for another deeply passionate and determined person, the journalist and human rights activist Humaira Avesh Shahid. She's going to share her story of fighting for women's rights in Pakistan. And she makes a case for Islam as a positive, even progressive, transformative force in the Middle East. Something quite different than what we generally hear here. We'll be back with that story when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Humaira Avesh Shahid spent her early life in Kuwait with her Pakistani family. She grew up having the freedom to walk to the beach alone, pursue her studies, and with no conception that her gender might lessen her worth as a human being. That all changed when she moved to Lahore for school as a teenager. No longer permitted outside alone, she found refuge in Western literature and then pursued the life of a quiet academic. That was not to be. Humaira met and married the scion of one of Pakistan's premier newspapers, became a mother, an editor, and an activist, and she confronted stories of acid attacks on women, the trading of girls to settle tribal disputes, and other abuses. Humaira was eventually seated in the powerful Punjab Regional Assembly, where she challenged corruption, cruelty, usury, and violence against women, girls, and the poor with legislation. Her fight is for laws that may not agree with Pakistan's tribal traditions, but that she believes are true to the message of the Quran. Her new memoir is Devotion and Defiance and was written with Kelly Horan. And Humaira Avesh Shahid joins us now from the BBC in London. Humaira, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
Now, how was it that you escaped such gender disparity growing up? Were your parents especially liberal?
Well, my book is a peep for the Western leader that how the majority of the Muslim families are. I mean, my father and my husband were my supporters. I was celebrated by my father. I was encouraged. Not all fathers are brutal to their daughters. We may have experiences in the lower income groups and lower classes, and the reason is ignorance and poverty and cultural conservatism. But families from middle class and upper middle class and the elites, you'll find women in better conditions, and because of the education, because of the exposure, because of the way my father, the family and my extended family is. Even in my grandfather's, you'll never find somebody who's abusive or who's against having daughters. So this is just a reminder for the Western reader what a normal Muslim family is like.
So your life continued in this other Pakistan, the one that was sort of elite. You shrugged off a couple of marriage proposals, but then met and fell in love with and married Adnan Shahid, the son of one of Pakistan's most respected newspaper publishers, which threw you into this kind of rarefied world of politics discussed over dinner and journalists and powerful players in the Pakistani firmament. How much awareness of life for those less privileged, that other reality, did you have at that point?
I was coming from a very protected environment. The male members I was surrounded by, I was loved by them. I've always seen encouragement. And when I got married to this media family, the family had similar values. I mean, my father-in-law had always encouraged me to, you know, show my potential, to be who I am, to speak out. And I was very outspoken from the beginning. What I never thought was how the downtrodden people lived. I'd heard about that. I'd read about that. But I had never encountered such violent, first-hand experience of violence and brutality that I came across when I was doing these stories on women, women victims. It just transformed me. It made me grateful the kind of life I had, but it also made me guilty of how people like me are not contributing and towards people who are underprivileged, how it is a social responsibility of the community to protect others, to provide for others, to take care of the others. And I think that kind of responsibility And that kind of awareness changed me forever, because repeatedly when I encountered resistance in the parliament and I was criticized, I knew that I had made a promise to those women.
Mm.
Even if they didn't know about it, I was reminded of what they went through. It is my moral and social responsibility to do what I'm doing today.
Well, you and so many other people were shielded from the truth until you took over what were called the women's pages for one of the newspapers, and later the helpline, another section of the paper. Now, give us a sense of what those respective sections were like before you started editing them, and what kind of stories you did eventually cover.
Well, those pages were full of what to buy, how to look, fashion, and entertainment, a lot of frivolous things, which I thought was a waste of space. Not that I'm against the entertainment side of the news pages, but I thought in a country where women had such hardships and where women were had such a marginal representation and a marginal role, it is my responsibility as a female journalist to sensitize people on the issues of exploitation and violence against women. And we must have a solution base. So I usually used to invite women who were distinguished in their own ways, you know, ministers or lawyers and educators, to bring forward a serious, a profound image of women. I wanted those pages to carry human rights stories. You see, reading about rape and meeting a real victim of rape, is there's a lot of difference in that.
Hmm.
And I wanted the women, the readers of my newspaper, to probe into the issues of minors and poverty and violence.
And at the same time, women reporters couldn't even go to places to cover some of these issues, you know, where the prostitutes were living in or eunuchs, for example.
You see, that was the reason, not because that we didn't encourage that. It was because some female reporters were coming from very conservative backgrounds. And we did not want to encourage any conflict with their families. And when we did have an alternate of a male reporter accompanying them, or you know, and asking a male reporter to do that. So there were, I had a couple of female reporters who were very bold and very courageous, and they did these stories, while there were others who were timid and had issues with their families.
Well, there are so many stories of women violated by husbands or in-laws or suitors who didn't get their way, or they got no help from the police or the courts, certainly. You share so many of these stories in the book. One memorable one comes to me when you and your husband are visiting Multan. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
Multan.
Yes, Multan.
Multan. And you meet a poor old man. He's got a 15-year-old daughter, Parveen, who was captured and violated, and I'm presuming raped, by his son-in-law. Mm. Now, he thought he was owed a wife. He had married one of the man's daughters, and she died, so he thought he was owed a wife. So he appeals to you, who by that time had been, you know, very well known for the helpline. And you, a woman, are allowed to attend the tribal council, where they come up with a solution. Can you bring us back to that scene and how they resolved it?
Well, it is one of the stories that still shakes me. A father ends up marrying his daughter to the rapist, and he says, and one of the reasons that he gives to me was that because his daughter is dishonored, no man will accept her in marriage, and he was worried about what would happen once he's gone and he's dead, and where would he leave his daughter? The second thing is how the social norms around you, the whole idea of social acceptability, is so important to these rural families for survival. I think I'd never experienced that. I've never, before that, village councils, I'd seen them, but I'd never been sat through the proceedings. So it was for me a very different experience, and I entered the scene with anger and frustration, and I will not let them do this. And I came back despondent, realizing how grave the context was, how chained the people were. And beyond a point, I'm not able to help them because I just cannot interfere beyond a point. And for them, that village council, their tribal values, their social values, and their tribal affiliations were much more important than what that little girl had gone through and why she was forced to get married to the rapist. So it is one of the experiences that horrified me even today.
Mm. Well, you point out that in many of these tribal councils, there aren't very many people who can read, and people haven't actually read the Quran, yet many of them invoke the Quran in defense of inhumane treatment of women and girls. How is this different from your faith, your view of Islam as dictated by the Quran?
I believe that the kind of Islam that we have in Pakistan is puritanic version of Islam. Sharia is chosen out of context and is primarily reduced to the sexual morality of women. It is reduced to the how women dress up and their demeanors. I believe that the more I drenched into my religion, the more I spoke to the religious scholars, I realized 70% of Sharia is about economic matters. It is about your business contracts. It is about social welfare, your contribution to the community, to the society. It is your duty to take care and contribute to the welfare of a common man. Nobody talks about that aspect of Sharia. Nobody talks about the kind of social welfare model we had. Nobody talks about how the rich contributed to sustain the poor. Recently, and I believe in the last few decades, Islam has been reduced to women and their behavior, and it has become extremely judgmental, and I totally disagree with that. Islam is not obsessed about women. Let's talk about 1,000 Arabian Nights, the kind of literature that celebrated women, that was sensuous, that was aesthetic. I mean, look at the Mughal paintings. The Mughal art and the kind of poetry we have had in the subcontinent, this misogynism, this over-obsession with the morality of women is a recent phenomenon in our countries.
We're talking with Humaira Aves Shahid. She's a working journalist, an activist, and a former legislator in Pakistan, one of few. She's been threatened, ridiculed, had her microphone cut off mid-sentence for demanding humane treatment of women and girls, and advocates against what she calls political Islam in a new memoir called Devotion and Defiance. Well, Humaira, in 2002, you were chosen for a seat in the reserved women's section of the Punjab Provisional Assembly. You were jeered, you were catcalled when you stood to defend or legislate for people who'd been abused, still pushed forward. I'm curious about what it is with you. After all these stories we get about women abused and even people at your father-in-law's dinner table kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, this is just how it goes. What is it in you that just could not abide in this kind of treatment?
Well, one of the things the people in my family said that this is something that the police should do, and you're not the police, you're just a journalist, you're just responsible of bringing that to the eyes of the public, not beyond that. And I think the activist streak in me was very strong since the beginning. I'm not here to make a career. I was not there to have bylines. I was not there to to carve something else. I was there because I was moved by those people. I felt a moral responsibility towards those women. And when I got the opportunity and a position in the parliament, I was haunted by what I had experienced. And I would have never forgiven myself if I wasn't able to bring those forward. And even today, I do all this because, not for others, I do it for myself. Because I don't want an amputated spirit. I want to, this strengthens my spirit. It gives me courage. It takes me transcend this worldly, mundane selfishness that we have in our existence. I think all these experiences have been a source of spiritual evolution for me.
Humaira, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure indeed.
Humaira Aves Shahid, she and the writer Kelly Horan together wrote Devotion and Defiance. Reviews and more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
We are grateful for your listening time today. If you did enjoy what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.